From Texas to Ohio, Florida to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, it was called the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, but it is proving to be less than affordable as premiums are skyrocketing. Dean Clancy from Americans for Prosperity is here to discuss. Raphael Warnock survived a runoff election in Georgia, and Democrats now have majority control of the U.S. Senate. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. President Joe Biden recently celebrated his 80th birthday. He is one of many aged Americans holding key government posts. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores whether it is time for a new generation of leaders. And once again, Congress is working to raise the nation's debt ceiling. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Jonathan Williams from the Legislative Exchange Council says the problem isn't a lack of tax revenue. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It was touted as a way to make healthcare affordable for millions of Americans. But under the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare, healthcare premiums continue to rise. Dean Clancy is Senior Policy Fellow at Americans for Prosperity and a public advisor for the Paragon Health Institute. He is here to talk about the latest spike in Obamacare costs. Dean, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Dean, tell us a bit about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which has proven to be anything but affordable. Supposedly was going to cut medical costs for Americans, but another increase on the horizon?
Yeah, that's right. Obamacare was supposed to cut health care costs, and it's actually doubled health insurance premiums since 2010. And this year, we're seeing increases in the range of 25% in the individual purchase health insurance market, and 10% in the workplace market. And we can expect huge increases in the future thanks to massive subsidy increases in the recently enacted Inflation Reduction Act, or as I call it, the Inflation Acceleration Act.
Talk a little bit more about that, Dean. The Inflation Reduction Act supposedly was, well, going to cut the rate of inflation, which it really hasn't done. How is it that it is adding to the cost here of healthcare?
The bill, which was a big package, as you recall, of spending, it got through because Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia dropped his opposition, and it was able to get through by a single vote. It's lots of stuff in there, but included was a massive increase in spending on Obamacare subsidies. Right now, the average Obamacare health insurance plan costs like $20,000 a year, and yet they're advertised as only a few dollars a month, $25 a month, $50 a month. How can that be? Well, taxpayers are covering almost all of the cost, and because the bill not only increased the subsidies, but increased who can have them. So they basically lifted the income cap. That means that you could be making $250,000 a year in some parts of this country, and you are going to qualify for taxpayer subsidies towards your health insurance. And so that has increased the amount of money spent on these subsidies by hundreds of billions of dollars. And that money is going to the insurance companies, and it's going to ultimately lead to higher healthcare costs for everybody. There's also a big increase in the Inflation Reduction Act in Medicaid spending. And this is a story we need to keep an eye on because the Biden administration and progressives have been trying to swell the ranks of the Medicaid program. That's the joint federal-state health insurance program for the poor. It's becoming a middle-class entitlement. Millions of people on the rolls now who are really ineligible for benefits or who make more money than you would consider to be truly poor, all because of policy changes made in the last couple of years. So the Inflation Reduction Act really has pumped hundreds of billions into the health industry. That's, by the way, really improved the profits of the health insurance companies. They're making double-digit improvements in their profits over the last year just because of these government subsidies. So we should expect our premiums to keep going up.
Has any of this resulted in an improvement in the quality of health care?
No. In fact, it's gone down. It's getting harder, thanks to the Affordable Care Act and its mandates, it's getting harder to find a doctor who's in your health plan's network or a facility. That's called network shrinkage, and it's been happening since Obamacare came in. Basically, the structure of the mandates and subsidies is such that the insurers have powerful incentives to increase their premiums, but to shrink their networks. And so people are getting squeezed, and the quality of care is going down in that market. If you go on Obamacare and get a subsidized plan, it's not that much different from being on a Medicaid HMO, which is probably the worst form of health insurance in America. I would say it almost doesn't even qualify as health care. You've got a card in your hand, an insurance card, but you don't necessarily have access to doctors and hospitals that you need and trust. And that's happening because of Obamacare.
There are some potential alternatives that have been suggested, including something known as the personal option. Can you tell us a bit about that, please?
Sure. At Americans for Prosperity, we think we can make American healthcare significantly more affordable and better if we use market forces. What do we want in healthcare? We want it to be more like shopping online, Amazon.com, or the gas station or the grocery store. There's no reason why healthcare can't work like that and be affordable for everybody. So personal option is a way of saying the patient back at the center of care. In American healthcare, the patient is not the customer these days. The patient is the product. The real customers are these big insurance corporations, hospital companies, and of course, government. Well, how do you put the patient back at the center? First of all, remove obstacles between patients and care so that, for example, people can use telehealth without having to ask permission, which is a great way to save money and it improves outcomes. Let hospitals expand and add new beds and MRI machines and so on without having to ask government permission, which occurs all the time now. There's these huge barriers to expanding the supply of health care, and there are many rules like that. And then on the other side, why don't we make sure that the patient, the customer, can save and pay for health care tax-free, for example, with a tax-free health savings account. That's something that exists today. Millions of people have them, about 30 million, but about 90% of Americans have no access to this powerful financial tool that in effect gives you double-digit percentage discounts on every medical purchase. And the last thing is, why not let people just pay for health care out of pocket directly? That's a personal option approach.
And if we have listeners, Dean, who would like to learn more about this personal option, more free market approach, where can they go on the web to get this information?
I would advise folks to go to personaloption.com. That's a website where you can learn more about this whole health reform agenda and get involved. Again, that's personaloption.com.
And tell us a little bit about Americans for Prosperity.
Americans for Prosperity is a national grassroots advocacy organization.
Dean Clancy, Senior Policy Fellow at Americans for Prosperity, also with the Paragon Health Institute, where he is a public advisor. Dean, thank you for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, of course, joins us every week here on American Radio Journal to take a look at politics around the country and what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Washington. Scott, good to have you back with us.
Great to be back.
We'll start out with the last U.S. Senate seat to be decided in the 2022 cycle, a runoff in Georgia. What happened?
Well, in short, Herschel Walker came up just a few points short. The Democrat incumbent, Raphael Warnock, won a full six-year term. And what this really means is that we're going to be dealing with a 51-49 United States Senate for the next 2 years, controlled by Chuck Schumer. And a lot of the fingerprints of the Biden administration will be all over that United States Senate as well. Mr. Walker ran a tough campaign. It was a close race, but we did win statewide elections, including the governor's race in Georgia just a few weeks ago with Brian Kemp winning re-election. So there's always a question about voter enthusiasm heading into these runoff elections, and Georgia is one of those states that has them. And I think in this instance, there are some incumbency advantages for Raphael Warnock. Without a doubt, he was able to raise just enormous amounts of money the entire cycle, really. And Herschel Walker was also a pretty prolific fundraiser. But when it comes to a big, big state like Georgia, when you've got basically triple the amount of money as your opponent, and we're talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars on the Democrat side being spent at the candidate rate, it can make a big difference in doing direct voter contact. So I think that was a big advantage that Warnock had, and ultimately we'll have to face those consequences.
So Democrats now will have a 51-49 control of the U.S. Senate. A different story, though, over in the U.S. House of Representatives, Scott, where Republicans have reclaimed a majority, but there is significant drama around who will be Speaker of the House. Want to fill us in?
A few weeks ago, Kevin McCarthy won the nomination to be the Republican Speaker, but he was 36 votes short of receiving unanimous support in the House of Representatives, and we've only got 222 seats. So kind of getting into the weeds a little bit for the listeners this week, Kevin McCarthy will still need to receive a majority of members that are present and voting for a person. Imagine if your member of Congress stood up on the House floor and said, for Speaker of the House of Representatives, I vote for Mickey Mouse. Okay, so that vote wouldn't count, and it would bring the overall number of the House down by one. Right now we're at 434. There was a death of a Virginia congressman a couple of weeks ago after the general election. And so McCarthy can only lose about 9 votes, and there are currently 5 House Republicans that have come out publicly against Kevin McCarthy for Speaker. But there are more that, to my understanding, have directly communicated to Leader McCarthy that they will not be supporting him for Speaker on the first ballot. So it'll really create this dilemma. And I should also point out that it's not just House Freedom Caucus Republicans, but there's Republicans from other elements of the Republican conference that do intend to oppose McCarthy right now. So McCarthy's working really hard to relieve their concerns. He's offering waivers for committee assignments. He's creating select committees. He's trying to demonstrate how he's fought for conservative victories in the past, even though we've come up short darn near every time. And I think that it continues to be sort of this conversation that's going to extend all the way to January 3rd when we have the first round. Andy Biggs announced that he is running against Leader McCarthy for the Speaker position. Biggs is a House conservative from the Freedom Caucus. And when he was in the state legislature, he actually served as a Senate Majority Leader in Arizona several years ago. So he has leadership experience. And I think that how the votes shake out, it'll extend to multiple ballots. And we'll see if McCarthy can ultimately get the votes required to become the Speaker, or if it becomes somebody else.
More drama relative to the Speaker's race. There's also drama this week, in as much as we have no federal budget, which was due back the 1st of October. We're under a continuing resolution that runs out. What do we think is going to happen here over the next few days?
The continuing resolution is up on December 16th. There's a lot of conversation ongoing about whether an omnibus appropriations bill can be completed to fund the federal government through September 30th. Of 2023. I think that the new Republican House majority is interested in a short-term continuing resolution that funds government at current levels sometime into the early months of 2023 so that they can use their new majority, the one that voters elected and gave Republicans a new mandate to govern on against the Biden administration, so that they need that leverage, right? And if we just kind of give up everything right now in December, we'll lose one of the bigger points of leverage against the Biden administration for all of 2023. You've also got the debt limit that's hanging out there, and then we'll have a farm bill reauthorization in late 2023. But in the interim period, how the funding of the federal government is adjudicated on the House floor is really up for serious question. I think that if I were a betting man, I would say there are enough Republican senators right now that are also concerned about the process. But you do have the retirement of Richard Shelby and Patrick Leahy, the chairman and vice chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. And whenever there's this sort of a dynamic of members that have led the committee for a long time, I know that their staff and the Uniparty, the establishment in Washington, the military-industrial complex, all these folks that are used to getting their piece of the pie in the end of the calendar year, they're expecting a deal to come together late next week.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization united in economic freedom. You can check us out at clubforgrowth.org, and you can actually become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being with us.
All right. Thank you.
In his inaugural address, President John F. Kennedy said, "The torch has been passed to a new generation of leaders. Is it time for that torch to again change hands?" Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports.
Anyone who pays even a modest bit of attention to American politics is probably aware of the fact that this country is ruled by a group of leaders that likely would have been forced into retirement long ago in a more normal profession. Some of them finally are stepping aside, at least a bit. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, for example, says that she is not running for another term as Speaker, though she will remain in the House of Representatives for another term when the new Congress begins in January. And I think this moment gives us an opportunity to appreciate the fact that Nancy Pelosi really embodied America's gerontocracy problem for the last decade or two. She was the beneficiary of a political system that has limited opportunity for new ideas and new faces because the old folks are just sticking around way too long. Hi, folks. It's Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. This week, we're just going to take a look at, as the year comes to an end here, kind of take a look back at not just the past year, but the past couple of decades where we've had the same group of leaders, at least in terms of the House Democratic Caucus. And there is finally some turnover happening there. I think we have to put some numbers on this, some ages on this, just to really appreciate the scope of America's gerontocracy problem. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, they were the oldest pair of major presidential nominees in American history when they ran for office against each other in 2016. And that was a record that they held for all of 4 years, because then it was Joe Biden and Donald Trump who became the oldest pair of major party presidential nominees in American history. But Biden, who just turned 80 years old, and Trump, who is 76, look a bit like young whippersnappers compared to the old folks who have been running the House Democratic Caucus for the past decade or more. As I said, Pelosi has been in charge of things for a while. She's 82 years old. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer is 83. Democratic Whip James Clyburn, he's the third in command. He is also 82, like Pelosi. All three of them have thankfully announced their intention not to seek re-election to those leadership positions when the new session of Congress begins in January, though they will, of course, remain in Congress for another term. Republicans have fewer long-term members of the House, and that's probably in part due to two things. On one hand, there are rules that the Republican caucus operates under that the Democrats don't, which limit the tenure of committee chairs. And effectively, what that does is it encourages lawmakers to retire if they can't move up into senior leadership roles because they can't continue to be chairman of key committees. And I think also in part of the reason for that is that they're just sort of a stronger anti-incumbency sentiment within conservative grassroots circles than there are on the left. But in the Senate, of course, Republicans have plenty of really long-term members, including the ancient Senator Chuck Grassley, who was just reelected in November to a new 6-year term at age 89. Now, look, that so many members of America's prominent political leadership are so long in the tooth is, on one hand, compelling evidence that we're living longer, healthier lives than ever before. People can continue to work longer than they used to, and that includes people who work in government. But on the other hand, it also means that for the past several years, for the past decade really, Congress has been unable to enact any substantial policy without the support of several people born during the Roosevelt administration, including Pelosi, Trump, Biden, all of these folks were born so long ago that they're not even baby boomers. They're actually from the so-called silent generation that preceded the baby boom. Now, it shouldn't be surprising, of course, that politicians are out of touch, but the real issue here is that Congress is increasingly unrepresentative of the country that it supposedly runs, of the people that it supposedly represents. The average American is now a full two decades younger than the average member of Congress. And the average member of Congress would be 59 years old right now, is a full two decades younger than the president and the outgoing Speaker of the House. This widening gulf between the average American and their elected officials creates bad incentives, I think, for policymaking. Now look, Pelosi, Hoyer, Clyburn, Trump, Biden, all of these older folks are not, of course, single-handedly responsible for this trend, but they are all illustrative examples of a generation that was allowed to hold on to power probably for far too long. End of the system that let them do it. And I think it's interesting to consider the fact that this is really a uniquely American problem. Kevin Munger, a political science professor at Penn State University who recently wrote a book about generational conflict in politics, told New York Magazine last year that gerontocracy appears to be a uniquely American problem. If you look at other countries, he said, they're not similarly controlled by older politicians. I think the explanation here is that the two-party system. He went on to say that a multi-party system gets more young people involved in politics, voting, organizing, running things, and that means that they start accumulating institutional power at an earlier age. In other words, America's tightly protected two-party system limits the opportunities for new faces and new ideas because it limits the sort of fringy, outsidery politics that help get young people into politics in the first place. So it cuts off that pipeline for where new ideas might come from, where new political leaders might come from in the first place. Giving aging lawmakers the boot is, of course, ultimately the responsibility of voters. Term limits are one idea that gets kicked around when people talk about this issue, and it has broad support in polls, but I think it's not really the best solution. For one thing, it's technically anti-democratic. If lawmakers in San Francisco want to elect Nancy Pelosi 19 times in a row, hey, that's their right to do it. I think it's a mistake, but they should be allowed to do it. I think a better idea here, although also a completely unworkable one, so just bear with me, would be setting a maximum age for lawmakers. And this would be in keeping with something that's already in the U.S. Constitution. There are minimum ages, of course, in the Constitution. For serving in the House, you have to be 25 years old. For being in the Senate, you have to be 30, and you can't be president until you are at least 35 years old. So we should just flip that around, right? Make sure that no president can be elected after age 65, no senator after age 70, and no member of the House after age 75. That would be a perfectly legitimate limitation, I think, to impose on the system. So Nancy Pelosi's tenure as Speaker of the House is finally over, but until there's some real changes, maybe structural, maybe political, the gerontocracy in America is still going strong. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of what's going on in Congress and around the rest of the country this week at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Overspending, not a lack of tax revenue, is responsible for the nation's rapidly growing national debt. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Congress is once again, almost unbelievably, considering an expansion to its capacity to deficit spend. As of now, the federal government is quickly approaching the debt ceiling of over $31 trillion set by Congress last December, which itself raised the debt ceiling by another $2.5 trillion. That's right, in the past year alone, we have nearly reached that massively higher debt ceiling. To put that in perspective, it took the federal government until roughly 1980 for the debt limit to hit $1 trillion for the very first time in our nation's history. Of course, it is this federal government overspending and the resulting monetary policy that are the key drivers to our record 40-year high inflation problems. It is important to remind ourselves that Congress can avoid defaulting on its debts without raising the debt ceiling. Spending at a deficit is what incurs debt and what causes the federal government to have this now nearly annual discussion around the debt limit. A balanced federal budget that keeps spending below collected revenues would keep Congress from needing to continue this political drama of raising the debt ceiling. Let us not forget that all of this is happening at a time of record federal tax collections. So it is unambiguously clear that our debt problems are not caused by a lack of revenue, but instead an addiction to overspending. The national debt now looms at just over $31.4 trillion. While that is an unfathomable number, the sad truth is it is easy to become desensitized to the massive difference in magnitude between the numbers 1 million, 1 billion, and 1 trillion. According to a quick internet search, it would take about 11 days to count to 1 million, and about 30 years to count to 1 billion. And what about 1 trillion? Well, as Ken Ivory, the chairman of our ALEC Center to Restore the Balance of Government and Utah representative now, put it, counting by ones, it takes more than 32,000 years to count to $1 trillion. And that's allotting only 1 second for numbers like 999,999,999,999,999. You get the picture. The federal debt now exceeds $248,000 for every taxpayer in America. This is clearly not sustainable, no matter how many times the debt ceiling is raised or suspended. If Congress fails to start implementing fiscally responsible policies, Americans will pay the price in higher taxes and foregone economic growth. Something that hits close to home today is the cost that overspending brings in the form of ugly price inflation we continue to see at gas stations and grocery stores across America. Let us not forget our debt and our deficits were not caused by a lack of tax revenue. Also, let's remember some basic lessons from our 50 states, the laboratories of democracy. 49 out of the 50 states have balanced budget requirements in their law, contrary to Washington, D.C., Now, some state budget requirements are far better than others, but one of the very best is also one that was most recently adopted. Before becoming Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, as Governor of Indiana, led an important effort with Indiana legislators to create the model state balanced budget amendment. With more than 70% voting in support, Indiana residents added this meaningful balanced budget requirement into their state constitution in 2018. It shows fiscal responsibility can also be handsomely rewarded by voters when done well. In addition, several states have tax and expenditure limits, or TELs. Colorado's Taxpayer Bill of Rights, or TABOR, is the limit with the highest profile, and that's really for good reason, as it's been the gold standard for taxpayer protection now for 30 years in the Colorado Constitution. TABOR empowers taxpayers to be a part of the tax and budget process in Colorado and limits the growth of tax collections and spending to the combined percentage of population and inflation growth. If tax collections go beyond that limit, hardworking taxpayers receive an automatic tax refund check as a dividend for fiscally responsible government and spending control. Most good ideas come from the states, and once again, our system of competitive federalism points out the right policy ideas that can help address some of the most challenging policy issues at the federal level, like our overspending and debt. Irresponsible deficit spending has created the federal debt problem, and unfortunately, that political drama around the federal debt ceiling will continue until Congress can learn from the states and pass responsible budgets. For more information, visit ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KDLC-FM, KJIN-AM, and WGUO-FM, all in Yuma, Arizona. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.